The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to UCI Conversations, a weekly public affairs program dedicated to exploring everything in the land of blue and gold with interviews of UCI leaders, innovators, and last but not least, zot, 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 everyday anteaters.
Hello, everybody. This is UCI Conversations, and I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeier. And my very special guest today is a man who became interim provost and interim executive vice chancellor at a critical time for our campus. It was March 2020, just as COVID-19 hit with a bang and shut down our school practically overnight. Recently, after an extensive nationwide search, he was formally appointed UCI provost and executive vice chancellor. Wow, it has been quite a tenure so far in this year of a million memories. Congratulations and welcome to the show, Hal Stern. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Kevin. Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm really excited to be here.
Super. Great to have you. We'll get to your current duties, but before that, let's just hear about your life journey. Can you please tell us where you grew up and what you like to do when you were a kid?
Sure. So I grew up in New York City, primarily in Queens, and as a child, was very interested in sports, not particularly good at sports, but very interested in sports, both playing them on the street and in the schoolyard and watching a lot of sports. So my father was a huge sports fan, and so myself and my brothers were as well.
Oh, great. Any particular sport favorites?
No, well, I like all sports. I love baseball, basketball, more recently, soccer.
Were you a Mets fan? The Mets are in Queens, aren't they?
They are in Queens. I did grow up very close to then Shea Stadium, now Citi Field, and was a diehard Mets fan growing up. Moved around quite a bit since then, so have allegiance to several teams, including the Angels.
Were you still in Queens in high school?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Did you always know that you'd go to college, or when did that kind of come into the picture?
It's a really great question, an interesting question for me, because I am a first-generation student to go to college. That is, my parents did not go, but my father was very successful. And so from relatively early age, that is, when I was in middle school and certainly high school, I was planning all along on going to college.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What did your dad do?
He has a very interesting story. He served in the military, and then when he came out, he had learned stenography. He was a secretary for an executive in, I'll call it an import-export company. Basically, the company dealt in cocoa beans. So they would facilitate transactions between countries that produce cocoa and farms that produce cocoa and companies like Hershey and M&M that bought cocoa. And he was very successful, became the CEO's secretary and ultimately a senior vice president at the firm.
Wow, interesting. I happen to have been to Hershey Park in Pennsylvania a few years back. Was that ever a benefit of having a dad in the cocoa business?
The real benefit was the holiday gifts he used to get large packages from many of these companies. And he worked in the industry. I'm not quite sure I'm going to get this exactly right, but just shy of 50 years. So he really was one of the world's experts in cocoa. He was a high school graduate, grew up very poor, and was just very smart, picked it up very quickly, and really had an exceptional career.
Yeah, interesting. Did you always know that math would be what you'd study in college?
Early on in school, I had great success in math. I enjoyed the numbers. They tied into things like sports that I was interested in, all the statistics and the like. So I was always interested in mathematics, and that became my first choice. And so and it all worked out. So yes.
Oh, great. And boy, getting into MIT, that's not easy. I guess you had the grades to do that. Was that challenging to get into? Was it a goal, or you just applied and got in?
I applied to a range of schools and was really fortunate to get in at the time. I'm not sure. As I said, neither of my parents went to college, and so I didn't necessarily know quite so much about that process. And MIT seemed like a natural place for a math person. Turns out there may be other schools equally good, but I was really happy to go there and had a wonderful experience there.
Oh, yeah, great. Did high school come easy to you?
I should preface my answer by saying there are people you probably know who have these remarkable memories and can remember everything they've ever done. My memories of childhood are remarkably sketchy. I remember unbelievably little. When we talk about family, do you remember X, Y, and Z? Almost always the answer is no. I definitely remember, you know, that's about elementary school, but middle school and high school, for sure, I found things relatively easy and really enjoyed the math and found that easy. And professors, teachers were able to challenge me by pushing forward a little bit. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Excellent. So once you graduated with your undergrad, June of 1981 from MIT, then did you automatically know you were going to go to grad school, or how did that come about?
It's very interesting because I was interested in graduate school. I enjoyed college as well. It was challenging, but I enjoyed it. So I was interested in graduate school and found myself in the somewhat paradoxical position of feeling like I wanted to go to graduate school, but not quite knowing what in. That is, I was interested in mathematics, but not pure mathematics, and so didn't want to go to continue graduate school mathematics, and applied to a variety of programs, some business schools, some economics, but decided that none of them were exactly right. So I instead went to work for a company for a couple of years that was not the same as my father's, but in that industry, in the commodities business, it was a company. I'll fill in one blank, which is during college, I worked summers for this company because my father knew one of the people at the company. And so I worked there as a computer programmer during college, and they offered me a job when I finished. And so I went there and worked pretty much as a researcher, programmer, considering whether you could build automatic trading systems, things like that. And while I was there, I spent some time kind of refining what I was interested in, really came to learn that statistics was at the core of almost everything I found interesting. That is sports, commodity trading, stocks, finance. So that's when I decided to go to graduate school in statistics.
Interesting. You know, statistics, you know, on a you know, elementary level seems, you know, kind of straightforward. But obviously, when you're at the master's and PhD level, it must get a lot more complicated. Can you shed a little light on that?
Absolutely. I have a talk that I give, which begins with there's kind of statistics with a lowercase s and statistics with an uppercase s, the discipline. And, you know, so statistics in a lowercase s is absolutely straightforward. And we all get used to consuming statistics on a regular basis about the economy, about sports, about whatever we're interested in. Statistics with a capital S, and I will say I didn't appreciate this myself as an undergraduate, is really about the building the tools and techniques that allow people to learn from various types of data about science and policy questions of interest. And some of it is very straightforward. That is, the same tools apply across a variety of sciences. But as you get into more interesting types of data, you can think about, for example, images, or, you know, for me, one of the things I was very interested in was stock prices. How do you build methods that allow you to understand and maybe even predict in some of these settings? And so that's what, you know, the capital S statistics, the field of statistics, is really about.
Interesting. So how did you like going to Stanford?
I liked it very much. When I decided I wanted to pursue statistics, I really just, you know, bought a guidebook, applied to some of the top programs, was fortunate to be admitted to Stanford. I had lived my whole life on the East Coast, but Stanford had a very good reputation, was excited for the opportunity to go to the West Coast, and had a really positive experience there. I had a funny story, which is I when I moved out there, my reaction, I told my parents at the time, was the West Coast is great. I don't know why people choose to live on the East Coast when they can live on the West Coast. All this great weather and great outdoor activities.
Right. Very good. Did you have a mentor both at MIT and at Stanford? Did you feel like there was, you know, a go-to person, or was it like that?
Less so at MIT. A lot of good professors, but nobody that I was really locked in on or spent a ton of time with outside of class. You know, graduate school is a very different experience. There's a very strong mentoring relationship with some of the faculty. My advisor since passed, his name is Tom Cover. And when I got there, I was, as we've already talked about, very interested in sports and had read an article written by one of the Stanford professors, a pretty famous guy named Brad Efron. So I sought him out and he said, oh, you know, I did that article, but I don't do a lot in sports. If you're really interested, you should talk to Tom Cover. And so I made an appointment and talked to him. And for 4 years, we kind of worked together, both on some of the research, but also on some side projects about both finance and sports. That is, we had very common interests. He had gone to MIT as an undergraduate as well, actually. And he was really interested. He had spent some time taking time away and playing poker full time. So we had lots to talk about and worked on some fun projects together.
Very good. Maybe that was pre-Moneyball days, when over the decades, statistics really has become a very central player, I know, in baseball. Did you hear any rumblings about that? Or could you see that statistics was becoming a stronger and stronger useful force in baseball?
No, absolutely. And it really was kind of pre the Michael Lewis Moneyball, but it was the early days, really, of, you know, academics had been writing articles for a while. And in fact, when I went to talk to Tom, he shared with me an article that he had written. I don't remember the year, I'm not going to get it right, but 60s, 70s, on computing something they called an offensive earned run average. That would be what would happen if you had a player like Mike Trout and had him bat in all the spaces in the lineup. How many runs would such a team score? And the tools that he used to do that are very, very similar to the basic kind of modern Moneyball tools. And the big change that's happened in the last, you know, 20 years is the amount of data that's been gathered is remarkable. So the data that he worked with were very, what I would call the simple counts. How many singles, how many doubles, how many triples, how many home runs. And that's all he needed to work with. But now you have, you know, how hard the ball was hit and where it was hit and how hard the pitch was thrown and what angle the pitch was thrown at, what type of pitch and where were the fielders and all of those things. So it's just gotten incredibly more dramatic and fabulous to what people can do and expanded well beyond baseball. Baseball was one of the first because it is so statistical by its very nature. But now there's incredible work going on in all the sports.
So once you graduated from Stanford, was it automatic that you were going to go into academia or not?
It was not automatic for me, in part because I had worked for this commodity trading firm both before I went to Stanford and also several summers during the time I was at Stanford. I would come back to the East Coast and work for this company. So when I was graduating, they were there with a job offer. I really enjoyed working there and it was a fun environment, but I was intrigued by the academic. I loved the university community. And I remember having a conversation and deciding to really say, it was obvious that it would be easier to start in academics and leave if I decided I preferred the alternative, than to run that sequence in the opposite order. That is, if you started a private company, it's going to be a lot harder to break into academia. So I applied for academic jobs first.
Gotcha. And you went to work at Harvard, correct?
Yes. I had really a fortunate turn of events that led me to be an assistant professor at Harvard in 1987.
Yeah, please tell us. Harvard is one of the top schools. So how did that come about?
It really was good fortune. I realized to some extent off cycle from the usual way that people apply for jobs that I was going to finish and therefore could apply for academic jobs. So most people know going into their last academic year and they start applying in the fall. And I figured out just a few months later than that in talking to my advisor. So I was applying a little bit on the late side and couple of things happened. I did get a couple of job interviews on the East Coast at a couple of other universities. And a friend of mine had been offered a job at Harvard and turned it down. And she said, I know they're still looking. Maybe you should give them a call. So I called. They said, yeah, we're looking. You know, send us your stuff and let us know if you're coming East. And so I sent my stuff in. And then as it turned out, a couple of universities reached out to me and I planned a trip to the East Coast to interview there. And they had said, call. So I called to say, you know, I'm in your pool and I'm coming East. You said, call if I'm coming East. So they said, sure, come interview. So the whole thing seemed so ad hoc and random. I don't remember the sequence, but I think I was at Penn State at the beginning of the week and Rutgers at the end of the week. So I flew to Boston in between. I had friends in Boston, so I was happy to do it. And I had an interview at Harvard. And even that day, I met some people in the morning, as we do, and I was going to give a seminar in the afternoon. And on the way to lunch, I was walking with the department chair. And he kind of said, tell me a little bit about yourself, which to me meant he hadn't really done much reading of the application that I'd submitted in my record. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, this is going to be a fun day. And, you know, I've got a chance to see some friends and then I'll go on. Yeah. The rest of the way. And, you know, I met everybody in the department, a small department, and I gave my seminar. And as I was doing kind of the exit interview, he said, we'd really like you to come work here. And I was almost dumbfounded. And I said, you know, I still have one more interview. I can't accept this job. And so that's how I ended up at Harvard.
Yeah, very good. So excuse me just for a moment, Hal, while I update our listeners. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UCI Conversations. I'm your host, Kevin Bossemeyer, and my guest today is UCI Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor Hal Stern. We've been following his life and his life in education, and he's started his career after his PhD at Stanford at Harvard. And then how long were you at Harvard, Hal?
I was there for 7 years, enjoyed it very much. But one characteristic of Harvard is it is a very, very hard place to get tenure.
Is that right?
And in statistics, which was a very small department, I was there in the late 80s and early 90s. The last person to get tenure had done so in the 50s.
Wow.
And the next person got tenure about 50 years later in the early 2000s. So I was in the middle with a bunch of other people who didn't get tenure. So I started to look for other jobs when that became clear. And ended up going to Iowa State University, which has a long history in statistics because of the agricultural work, and had a really positive experience there as well.
Hmm. Did you ever connect with Song Richardson, the prior law school dean? Because I think she loved Iowa. I think it was at Ames, Iowa.
I'm not sure if she was in Ames or in Iowa City. One funny story, I got a chance to work with Song for my year as interim provost before she left to take the position at Colorado College. But there's a funny story, which was when she was appointed interim dean after Erwin Chemerinsky left, mm-hmm. just by complete coincidence, we were on a plane together to Iowa. And I said, you know, I congratulated her on the job. And we had a nice chat as we flew to Iowa together. And I asked her if she would consider becoming the full-time dean. And at the time, she said no. Obviously, she changed her mind or was persuaded otherwise.
Right. Oh, very good. And how long were you at Iowa State?
Great question. I was at Iowa State for 8 years. I moved as an associate professor. So I got tenure in that move. And then I became full professor there.
How did you come to UCI? At that point, once you're tenured, is it common that people will leave? How did that come about?
I really enjoyed my time in Iowa. It was very different for someone who had grown up on the East Coast, spent some time on the West Coast. And it's a wonderful town. Ames, Iowa is at the time was 50,000-ish, maybe 60,000 people, but really much smaller than I was used to. My wife and I had children there, and it's a great place to raise a family. That's one of the things they pride themselves on. But after 6-7 years, I began to want to be someplace with I'm not quite sure how to say it and not disparage Iowa. I don't mean to disparage Iowa, but for me, wanted to be in a little bit more of a population center. Mm-hmm. Had grown up, as I say, in New York City.
Right.
So it was basically me beginning to start to look a little bit about how might I return to the East Coast or the West Coast and look into some jobs. And I was at a statistics conference. There's a big one every summer, and was approached by statistician that I knew, not someone I knew particularly well, who worked in the economics department here. And he said, we're about to start a statistics department and we're going to run a recruitment for a founding chair. And people tell me you'd be great at this. Hope you'll consider applying me. He gave me the document, a job description. You know, I didn't do anything at the time, but, you know, I took it back to Iowa, talked about it with my wife. Just so happened, applied for two jobs that year and get offered both of them, which does not always happen, I can tell you that. And one was to be the founding chair of the statistics department at UC Irvine. The other was to become a department chair of a different statistics group in the Midwest, in Minneapolis.
Was the deciding factor just a higher profile location at UCI? Or
what? Yeah, I mean, both jobs were great opportunities and really excellent. You know, people at both were reaching out to me and trying to hire me. For me, I found the founding chair job super exciting. I didn't know a lot about UC Irvine at the time, but looked into it, looked into Orange County, was just really excited about, you know, UC Irvine has a unique position as the only research university in Orange County, one of the, I think, six most populous counties in the United States. The way I used to describe it to people was, you know, I was working in Iowa. Iowa's got about 2.6 million people and two major research universities. Mm-hmm. And then here's this county with 3 million plus people and one research university. So even though it's somewhat of a risk to come in a startup mode, I just didn't see how it could fail. It's just such a great, great environment. So I was really excited about the opportunity. My wife and I were both interested in Minneapolis and the opportunity here, but ultimately just really excited here. And it's been everything and more than I could have hoped.
That's great. Now, as the founding chair of the Department of Statistics, how did you have the foresight to put the department in the School of Computer Science instead of the School of Math and Physical Sciences? Do you remember that whole process, or was it like that?
No, it's a great question. And I came here as founding chair. I was literally a department of size one for the first year. Wow. I was the only faculty member in the department. And I spent that year going around meeting with some of the deans, especially the physical sciences dean, but also social sciences, biological sciences, places where, you know, a statistics department could potentially live, might live at other universities. And really, there were a variety of reasons. The School of Information Computer Science, more formally, was at that time a Department of Information Computer Science transitioning to become a School of Information Computer Science. And they, at some level, reached out because they were trying to broaden their portfolio of programs. And I looked at it and said, well, statistics is an information science. It's a computational science. It fits. All I ask is that you add an S at the end. So it became the School of Information and Computer Sciences. And I often tell people there are certainly situations where it's better to be lucky than good. I can't claim it was visionary at the time we did it back in 2002, 2003, but it sure looks visionary now. you know, the combination of computer science and informatics, which were the existing departments, and statistics are basically three of the pivotal contributors to data science, which has emerged since that time as an incredible growth field. As I said, a combination of intuition and good fortune, we look really visionary, and we've really benefited from that location.
And you really emphasize interdisciplinary work, interplay with different disciplines. Is that true?
That's very true. And I come by that in part by the nature of statistics, or I'm not quite sure it's a chicken and egg problem. I'm interested in that kind of work that is bringing things together, especially bringing statistics together with other fields. And the history of statistics is basically full of examples that are based primarily on people developing statistical approaches because they were needed to solve important problems in agriculture, in medicine. You know, even in World War II, some of the statistical developments were required in the waging of the war, that is quality control. How do you know your manufacturing is working the way it's supposed to manufacture? Some of the logistics of kind of that effort. So many, many stat departments in the US basically formed coming out of World War II as mathematicians got exposed to statistical problems in that context, and then form departments, often coming out of mathematics departments.
You've been very involved with biomedical. Can you give us an example of specifically an area that you brought statistics to that?
Sure. As I say, I was attracted to statistics in part because of the way it connects with all these problem areas. And so what problems one works on depends a little bit on where you are. And so when I was in Iowa State, the applications I worked on were actually in agriculture, where there's a large set of researchers who are always trying to figure out how to improve the yield of crops, or one of the teams I worked with animal agriculture. So how do you improve milk yield? And they have fairly sophisticated data. They keep detailed records on all of the cows and how productive they are and their offspring. So that was a collaboration I had there. When I moved to UC Irvine, it turns out the first people to knock on my door were from the School of Medicine. And there were people here who wanted collaborators. And so I've worked on a number of projects. The first big one was really around brain imaging. There was a grant from the NIH that was given to a faculty member in the School of Medicine here to try and build techniques for using brain imaging and being able to combine brain imaging studies done at different sites. Because the challenge at the time was individual sites might do a brain image of 10 schizophrenic patients and 10 controls, but gee, that's not a very large sample size. And so the NIH was interested in this. It was actually a consortium of universities led by UCI was formed to say, can we come up with tools and techniques that will allow us to take studies done at 8 or 10 universities, pool the data, and therefore learn more? And so that's an example of a place where I got involved in trying to develop statistical approaches for understanding how results might differ from site to site and how we might combine those data sets.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you joined us late, you're listening to UCI Conversations. I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeier, and my very special guest today is UCI Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor Hal Stern. Right now, we're discussing Hal's expertise in statistics and important distinctions. Can you describe, is there a common mistake that people make with statistics? Can you give a generalized answer like that?
Yeah, I don't know if I would frame it as a common mistake. I think of the two key concepts that underlie statistics as being uncertainty and variability. And so probability is really the term that's associated with uncertainty. And then statistics really has a lot to do with how we deal with variability. And so to me, uncertainty is not knowing and describing our likelihood that certain things will happen. And variability refers to the fact that when we take measurements, you know, there's always some degree of error or ambiguity that resolves itself and you get different answers. And so uncertainty and variability are the key concepts of statistics. And I wouldn't say it's a mistake, but I think those turn out to be genuinely hard concepts for people to completely understand. That is just the lay public. We like certainty. We don't like uncertainty. Mm. And, you know, one example from relatively recent history is, you know, the presidential election when Donald Trump was elected, the forecast of the 538 website, which I'm a big fan of, you know, the night before the election was that Hillary Clinton had 75% probability to win the election and Donald Trump about 25% probability. So everyone expected Hillary Clinton to win. And of course, she didn't. And there was this total backlash of the predictors got it all wrong. They were totally crazy. They didn't understand. To me, somebody who says there's a 25% chance of something happening is not wrong. That is, mm-hmm. you know, Trump was an underdog. Things turned his way and he won, right? Mm-hmm. 25% things happen all the time.
Right. Interesting.
People are not comfortable with it. And, you know, the other anecdote I'll mention similar. I happened to be in Iowa at the time the Gore versus Bush election was happening, another kind of exciting time. And you may remember they were counting ballots in Florida. And every time they counted, they got a different answer. And I remember talking to people, and these are people at Iowa State University, you know, professors who would say, I don't understand why they're getting a different answer every time they count. And again, that's variability. Statisticians understand at our core that that's going to happen, that if you go home and measure your desk twice, you're going to get a different answer. Right? The desk has a certain length. You can measure it. But, you know, when you measure it with a ruler, you're going to put it down a slightly different place. You might get slightly right. different answer. So understand that variability and making sense of it is really what we do.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Professor, how oftentimes, like when you're going to order something from Home Depot or whatever, like you'll go and you'll measure it, but now you're going to buy it. So you triple or quadruple times measure it. And like, I can say, yeah, very often it's going to be different. You know, that's why I check it four times to make sure that when I'm going to spend my money, I want to make sure. But it doesn't come out the right answer every time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not really a right or wrong. It's that's right. the variability. And we strive, you know, measuring something three or four times is effective because we know that average of four measurements is more likely to be accurate than a single measurement. Right. So that's why we do that a lot.
Yeah, gotcha. Very good. I know one of your big areas of research is Bayesian statistical methods. Can you give us a brief description of what that is? And you actually were a co-author on a book about that, right?
Correct. Bayesian statistical methods are a little bit complicated to describe, but I talked a little bit about uncertainty a few minutes ago. The way that statistical methods tend to work, and this is a little bit of a caricature, but not too much, is we think about some phenomena that we're interested in studying. A relatively simple example is we might be interested in understanding how someone's salary in the banking industry or whatever is related to the amount of experience they have, and which degrees they hold and other characteristics. You might be doing a study for a legal setting where you want to know if gender is having an effect on salaries or whatever. One of the ways that we often proceed is we build a mathematical model or a statistical model that relates salary to these predictors, experience, gender, degrees, and combines them using numbers that we call parameters. That is a model that relates data to parameters, which help us understand how the world operates. And the parameters are unknown, and we usually collect data and try to estimate them. And so when one talks about doing Bayesian statistical methods, which, as you correctly report, is my area of research interest, it really has to do with how we go about trying to estimate those parameters and learn them. And Bayesian methods really make extensive use of the laws of probability to try and take, what do I know about the parameters before I collect any data? Now I collect data. Now let me update my opinion. And that's known as a Bayesian approach. It has a long history. It's been somewhat controversial because the way that it works is you actually start by saying, what do I think about this unknown quantity before I collect data? So that's subjective prior opinion. And many people feel like that should not be part of a study like that. But my experience is, you know, without getting too technical, there are a lot of settings in which thinking that way is super helpful. And so those are the kinds of problems I tend to gravitate to and work on.
Gotcha. Yeah. On the other side of your brain now, the great former Celtics Clipper basketball coach Doc Rivers describes himself as very emotional. My question for you, are you emotional and do you ever lose your temper?
I guess I think of those as slightly different questions. I don't consider myself overly emotional. So that would be the answer to that. And then, but do I lose my temper? Absolutely. Rarely. And I hope increasingly rarely, but you know, if you have children, if you have a spouse, somewhat inevitably, you're going to lose your temper unless you're a better person than I am. So I do occasionally lose my temper, try not to.
Understood. How about statistic heroes? Do you have any?
It's a great question. Heroes are a little bit of a hard word. There are some great names. You know, R.A. Fisher is a very famous statistician. He was a geneticist and worked in agriculture in England in the 1920s and 30s, and really was published work that was really a precursor to many, many common methods. A very famous guy, not always right. He was implicated in some eugenics research, and he also was a pipe smoker and really argued as vehemently as he could that there was no link between smoking and cancer, even as the evidence began to mount. So no one's perfect, but so he's one kind of hero. And then, I had mentors. With my time at Harvard was actually, I was hired as an assistant professor. It was highly influential for me, though, because some senior faculty there, especially a fellow named Don Rubin, did statistical work that, to be completely honest, I had not been exposed to during my time at Stanford, that was highly interdisciplinary, collaborative, and applied. That is, was focused on statistical methods to solve real problems. And he made seminal contributions to what do you do when you have incomplete data? That is, people don't reply, they don't answer all the questions. That's an unbelievably common thing. That is, it's almost impossible to get a complete data set. You're always missing something. And he really developed seminal methods for that so obvious problem. And also for causal inference. That is, how do you draw cause and effect conclusions when you can't do an experiment? One of the pieces of statistics is we learned that a well-designed experiment is a good way to try and learn whether making a change, introducing a treatment for a disease, will lead to a cure in a cause and effect way. And that's great. But what I just described for Fisher, you can't do an experiment that will let you know that smoking causes cancer, because you're not going to randomly assign people some to smoke and some not and see which ones get cancer. Mm. So in settings like that, where you're just observing the world, but still want to try and draw causal conclusions, it's a really hard problem. Mm. And again, Don Rubin was working on that, making really key contributions. And so I thought of him as a real mentor in how statistics could be used to address really the critical problems that we care about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, the UCI Conversation Show. My guest today is newly appointed UCI Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor Hal Stern. Many of Professor Stern's academic colleagues speak very highly of him becoming provost. Here he explains how he progressed in university leadership roles over the years.
Have you always aspired to, I see you are a vice provost of academic planning. Is the provost area, did that have a calling for you?
It's a great question. I, as you know, when we talked about earlier, came to be a department chair here. I found I liked some elements of that administrative job. Nobody, I don't think 100% loves administration, but I found as chair, I could really do things to help my colleagues and the students. We built a graduate program and started a graduate program. So I enjoyed that. And that led to an opportunity to serve as the dean of the Donald Brent School of Information and Computer Sciences. And again, that was, for me, my interest in doing that was partly to learn a little bit more about how the university works and to be able to help the school at a time when I thought that it needed help. As I did some of these administrative jobs, I found value in helping people achieve the best that they could, both students, staff, and faculty. And so I enjoyed those times, had stepped down from being the dean at the end of 2016, and went back to being a faculty member and enjoyed that again, a greater focus on teaching. I did research throughout my time as dean and department chair, but less teaching, the higher in the administration. So got back to teaching, enjoyed that. And my predecessor as provost reached out to me about would I consider becoming the vice provost for academic planning. And I was really interested in what we talked about in a couple of tasks, thinking about the budget for a large and diverse university like ours, and thinking a little bit about how we admit and enroll students, those kinds of things. And so was excited about that opportunity to help the institution in that way. At every step along the way, I was not keen necessarily to be provost. I did apply after being dean over the 3-4 years to a small number, a handful at most, of provost jobs, in part because I really enjoy UC Irvine so much that I was not keen to leave. And the vice provost job, when it was offered in September 2019, was in some respects the best of all worlds. That is, an opportunity to contribute again to the university, stay here at UC Irvine, and work on some of the university that I was really excited about.
I think people are often confused about what a provost is. Can you give us your definition?
Sure. The provost and the title here at UC Irvine and at many of our sister campuses, not all, is the provost and executive vice chancellor. And I think of those as two slightly different jobs that both, you know, reside in the same office here. The provost is the chief academic officer. And so in that piece of the job, I work very closely with the deans and with several of the vice provosts, one for graduate education, one for undergraduate education, on policies and programs for the students. What programs should we build? You know, the deans do and the departments do most of that work, but, you know, I work with them on those kinds of activities. As you may know, we're in the middle of a growth where we've been setting up new schools in the College of Health Sciences. So right now, my office is working with program and population and public health on a proposal for that to become a school. So those are provost type activities. The executive vice chancellor, the provost is said to be the chief academic officer. You can think about the executive vice chancellor as the chief operating officer, right? If the chancellor is the chief executive officer of our institution, then the executive vice chancellor is the chief operating officer. And so we have vice chancellors, for example, that handle finance and administration, a vice chancellor for student affairs, a vice chancellor for research, and a vice chancellor for human resources and strategic communication. So all of these functions kind of report up, and they report up to myself. So both of those are pieces of the jobs.
Gotcha. Well, we're quickly running out of time, Provost. You came on board literally as, you know, interim provost that the campus shut down because of COVID-19. Was that just a head spinning experience, or how was it?
It really was. The way I describe this to people is, you know, the previous provost had to step down. I was elevated, and I felt like if I had just been asked to serve as interim provost and there was no pandemic, that would have been really challenging, because jumping into the chair with no warning and no chance to ramp up. So I thought that would be hard. And now add a global pandemic on top of it. It was really crazy, crazy time. Just very changing so quickly. That is, as it became more serious and we emptied the campus, and as we began we did that successfully with really unbelievable team effort across the board, great people working very hard, great support from faculty, staff, and students, really to finish the 1920 year. And then when we set out to plan the 2021 year, just impossible to plan with so much uncertainty. I spent 10 minutes talking about uncertainty. As a statistician, I love uncertainty. As a provost, I'm not so crazy about it. We had to figure out how many students we would be able to accommodate on campus, how we were going to do instruction, what kinds of things could happen here. Just many, many decisions over and over again.
You know, in hindsight, do you look at, was there one big decision you're like, oh, that ended up being such an excellent decision? And is there any, I don't know, can you talk about that? Was there any decision like, you know, now that we know what it was, we would do things a little differently?
I think we really did well and tried to make the best decisions we could at the time. You know, one mistake we made, I think, is we underestimated how much testing we were going to want to do in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't ramp up there as quickly as some other universities, and ended up, again, through a heroic effort of many, many people on campus, building a robust testing infrastructure so that we could test all of the students who were on campus and try and keep them safe. But so that was one we didn't necessarily optimize, but we did really well. We were one of the first universities to build a robust contact tracing effort so that when there's a case, we had people in place and a partnership with Orange County to follow up our cases, find out who they've been in contact with, get those people to quarantine. So I think our university community, both in terms of the leadership and the steps we took, but more importantly, the community as a whole, the faculty, the staff, the students, acquitted ourselves really well through this pandemic. And it looks like, you know, we're doing really well through the vaccines and, you know, optimistic for the coming year, but a lot of hard work, a lot of great work.
Excellent. For you personally, the way you work, do you ever feel overwhelmed, and how you, obviously you're successful. So when you do, how do you handle that? Or maybe you don't. Can you give us a little insight into that?
Yeah, I think it's easy to get overwhelmed. There's a lot of moving pieces for a university this size and a lot of issues that cross my desk of all kinds, you know, promotions of faculty, new programs, legal issues, budget issues. So there are a lot. I absolutely occasionally feel overwhelmed. It's just important. It happens, in my view, to everyone. Step back, take a deep breath, get some perspective, get organized. What has to be done now? What can wait? And so I have lots of lists. And sometimes when they get overwhelming, I just kind of refine them and get back to them and make sure they're organized. So that's my approach.
How about with just a couple more minutes left, what amazes you about UCI?
I'm glad you asked, actually. I was attracted for reasons we discussed earlier to UCI. But what I found when I got here was a young campus of great ambition, doing incredibly noble work. That is the dedication to our student population, which is just incredibly diverse, 50% first generation in their families to go to college. It is an amazing number for a top 10 public university. My wife went to another highly regarded public university. Their number is 15%, right? And we're a Hispanic serving institution. We're an Asian American, Native American and Pacific Islander serving institution. Yet we're a top institution with great outcomes for our students. It's so exciting what we do here and the commitment of this campus to supporting diverse students, to creating an equitable environment and an inclusive environment. That it's a wonderful place to work. And I am just incredibly enthusiastic that I have the opportunity to support the university at the level I do.
Can you say that you enjoy the job, or are you too busy to even think about it?
I tell people I have no one to blame but myself, right? I was interim. I did not have to apply for the permanent job. I did apply. I enjoy it. The pieces for me are I like learning, and I found going from chair to dean, I learned more about the university, and going from dean to vice provost, and now from vice provost to provost, you learn more and more about the university. And I think universities, and especially our university, does such great work that that's really exciting to me. I'm also extremely committed to our mission, as I just described, and to our ability to interact with the community, Orange County, but beyond Orange County. You know, universities, in my mind, do great, great things. They're incredible engines for change for students and their families. They're incredible drivers for innovation and research. And it really is an exciting position. And we have a very strong community. I have felt incredibly supported, and it makes it a real treat to try and do the job.
Fantastic. Provost Stern, thank you so much for being with us today. We're out of time. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Thank you, Kevin. I really enjoyed the opportunity. All my best to you and the listeners.
Thank you again to Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor Hal Stern for all his insights into his life, the world of statistics, and his responsibilities as a key leader on campus. It was a pleasure. Overall, the feeling from academia and staff is that Hal Stern is the right man in the right place at the right time for this job. May he continue to successfully navigate us through COVID-19 and reopening this great institution called UCI. As he says, we are a young campus of great ambition, doing incredibly noble work. Hear, hear. And now coming up next at the top of the hour is Entrepreneur Nation with Ash Kumra, where the topic of the day is solutions to common business problems. Stay tuned. You've been listening to UCI Conversations, where every week we explore another corner in the land of blue and gold with interviews of UCI leaders, innovators, and zot, 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 everyday anteaters. Don't forget, you can hear this show and all previous UCI Conversations shows on my podcast website at www.bossenmeyer.com. And comments and suggestions are always welcome at kboss@kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeyer, encouraging you to keep working hard, spreading love, being kind, and if you've not done so yet, get that vaccine. I have, and it makes all the difference. Have a pleasant good evening. So long, everybody. Happy trails.